We're going to play that mini disc now live over the air, including the intro to the Hope Conference, which is a piece by Jello Biafra. And we'll see if we have actual audio coming up from that. There we go. All right, we are now hearing the beginning. And we'll be back in a little while. Again, if you're interested in a one-year subscription to 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, plus a copy of this videotape, which obviously you can't see on the radio, for a pledge of $100, they can be yours. 212-279-3400. You can call during the speech.
Constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorney. Shut up. Do not attempt to think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. sharp after work. Anyone caught outside the gates of their subdivision sectors after curfew will not remain. Do not panic. Your neighborhood watch officer will be by to collect urine samples in the morning. Anyone caught interfering with the collection of urine samples will be shot. Houses for trace elements at noon. Anyone who fails to display the required embossed black velvet Mexican painting of Alexander Haig on their living room wall will be shot. Cameras and surveillance equipment will be posted on all lampposts and streetlights. Anyone failing to attend required worship services on Sunday will be promptly arrested and dispatched to a re-education resort. Stay in your home. Remain calm. The number one enemy of progress is questions. National security is more important than individual will. All sports broadcasts will proceed as normal. No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. You are prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy. Obey all orders without question. The comfort you've demanded is now mandatory. Be happy. At last, everything is done for you.
Nobody move, you're all under arrest. You think I'm kidding?
Six.
It's kind of scary, isn't it? The good news is the power has shifted to individuals. Actually, I have notes on what Eric wants me to say. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about who am I, why am I here, and how can I help. And then I'm going to talk about some remarks that I made. Okay, thanks. Please shout out if I fade. And then we will go into some interactive questions and answers, and we can recognize the suits by their niche. So it'll be a ratio of one suit question to four hacker questions, and I'm authorized to enforce that. All right, who am I and why am I here? You've got to admit this is a pretty neat trick to produce a suit that talks your language or that is your friend. I'm here because when I worked on an artificial intelligence project at the Central Intelligence Agency, I read a lot. And one of the things I read was Howard Rheingold's Tools for Thought. And the other thing I read was Shirley Turkle's My Second Self. And those books literally changed my life. Shirley's book gave me an understanding of hacking. I am not a technical hacker. I'm an unemployment agency for hackers. And I do try and help link people together. But Shirley Turkle, with her book on MIT and the PDP and stuff, really made the point that hacking is an elegant piece of work. It's not a criminal act. And all these media people and all these government people that are going around saying hackers are criminals and, you know, we need to break them down. All these system operators. I mean, system operators used to be really smart people that had built the machines they were operating. Now a bunch of dumb administrators. And they get real upset when someone shows up in their system. And they think you should legislate that person away. Well, it doesn't work that way. So that book, those two books kind of got me started on a path, and ultimately I was asked by the Marine Corps to resign from the Central Intelligence Agency and serve as the senior civilian standing up the Marine Corps Intelligence Center. And I did that. And we spent $10 million on a top-secret classified system. And I talked a little bit about this earlier, so I won't belabor it. The bottom line is, after a lifetime of collecting secrets, I suddenly realized that most of my secrets were worthless. In terms of getting real work done. And when I did a cost analysis and looked at LexisNexis and BRS and EasyNet, and back then Internet was in its infancy in terms of content. It was mostly chatter. But I found that for $20,000 a year, I could answer 80% of the intelligence requirements of my general officers. And the beauty of it was the product was unclassified, which meant it could be shared with just about anybody. And I shared this with a member, a staff, a Marine reservist who was on the House Permanent Select Committee for Intelligence, and he wrote into the National Security Act of 1992 an Office for Open Source Exploitation. The Director of Central Intelligence was required to have an Open Source Intelligence Task Force, and he just didn't get it. Now, bear in mind, intelligence has always used open sources, but in the 60s and 70s, when we started getting into fancy satellites and clandestine ops against the Soviets, we kind of lost sight of our origins. The OSS, Miles Copeland's book Without Cloak and Dagger, talks about how when the OSS was first formed, they had all these lunatic requirements from the State Department, the Pentagon, and so on, and they put a guy in a room with the New York Times. And his job was to use the New York Times to answer these questions and just pretend it came from a very complex system of risky agents. It worked. It became the most important unit in the new CIA. We lost sight of that. We got too wrapped up in technical collection. We got too wrapped up in denied areas. We forgot the basics. So for me, working for the Marine Corps was a real privilege, and I learned a lot. But Gates just didn't get it. So I asked my general officer, actually asked my SES equivalent, for permission to run an international symposium on my own time to more or less jumpstart the issue of open source intelligence. And I got permission. I met the requirements of SECNAV Instruction 5000, which is that you declare your interest, you take no money from the Marine Corps, and your supervisor agrees it's in the best interest of the government. This is where Howard comes in. I tracked him down. I had no idea what a wild man he was. I mean, Tools for Thought is a very sane, rational book, and nowhere in there do you see anything about painted boots and magician's clothes and stuff like that. But I tracked Howard down. I got him to agree to speak. I pulled together people like Bob Kahn, Jay Keyworth, science advisor to the president, Paul Straussman. Admiral Studeman honored us with his presence and made some very sensible remarks. And don't misunderstand me. I am a strong supporter of the intelligence community. I think it needs to maintain its present level of funding.
I just think that Jim Woolsey has failed miserably at reinventing intelligence and getting it back to basics. So please, I am not in any way criticizing the intelligence community as a whole. I just think they need to get a life and come into the modern age. You know, it used to be the intelligence community with its satellites and stuff used to be like an oasis in the desert. But now they built a cement bunker around that oasis, and they don't realize that someone's come along and watered the desert, and all these private sector information capabilities have blossomed. And so their answer to taking advantage of that is to drill a little tiny hole in the cement bunker and stick a straw through it and suck on the Internet. Okay? And it's going to take them 5 to 10 years to really come up to speed if they continue with that approach. Anyway, to make a long story short, I got Howard there, and Howard's condition for agreeing to speak, outside of a few little things like money, was that I write an article for Whole Earth Review called Ethics, Ecology, Evolution, and Intelligence, an Alternate Paradigm for National Intelligence. The whole idea was to create a citizens intelligence corps, to put the power in the hands of the people, to allow people to be able to make informed judgments by having access. This includes government bureaucrats that are starved for information. The special assistant to the President of the United States and the National Economic Council told the Open Source Lunch Club that for economic strategy and economic decision-making in the White House, the intelligence community is useless because it's not allowed to look at the automobile industry and so on. And the rest of the government is lousy at the business of intelligence. They don't know how to do collection management and distill products and put them together and get them up into decision memoranda. So what we have is a really dumb government going through the motions along the machine model lines. Anyway, that article subsequently led to my going to Hackers 8.0 and Hackers 9.0, and I know that the management here doesn't recognize the Lake Tahoe hackers. They're the middle-aged guys that are now legal and making money. But that really started me getting to know people. I went out to Europe. Rop was very good to me. I gave a talk there, got to know Emmanuel and the 2600 environment. And in fact, when I started my conference, I started bringing hackers in. And this is one of the points I want to make. The suits that attended my conference were absolutely flabbergasted at the hackers. I mean, one of them, Tsutsu, the Japanese guy that does cellular hacking, talked to an SES, that's a general officer equivalent from DIA, and the guy came back to me later, bug-eyed. He said, I didn't realize. I mean, he had this perception of hackers as sleazeball criminals. And I think part of my role as your friend is to use my suit power to correct those misperceptions. Emmanuel was face-to-face with Greg Treverton, the vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at my conference last year. It was awesome. I mean, talk about two opposite but complementary poles of brilliance. Now, going on with this misperception thing, and I'll wrap up in about 5 minutes and we'll go into questions and answers. It bothers me that people don't understand that we have moved from the industrial era to the information era. And all these corporations, all these government bureaucracies, all these laws are from an old era. Thomas Jefferson was a hacker. He hacked the British Empire. The American Revolution broke British law, and it established new law. Thomas Jefferson, in his memorial in Washington, one of the four quotes that's up there, is that while he does not believe in the need for frequent changes in the law, he does believe that the law must keep pace with the human mind. No more would he have a man wear the coat of his youth than to have old laws applied to new eras. Now, our government hasn't figured that out yet. And one of the things that I really am eager to see the President of the United States do is to commission a presidential commission on cyberspace law. I have asked Brian Kahin from Harvard to join us at our symposium, and I'm trying to find $25,000 in funding for him to establish a new legal framework for cyberspace. I think one of the other points that the management wanted me to make is that you're not alone. You have now achieved critical mass. I think it's absolutely phenomenal to see this room full of bright people. You are the pioneers. like the pioneers of the Wild West, you are being crushed by the buffaloes. Bruce Sterling has written a book about it. Buffalo herd in the attack. You are being shot at. You are falling into crevices and dying by the trail. I just talked to Fiber Optic on the phone the other day. If anyone from Echo is here, be warned, I'm competing for his services. And I think that you represent a critical national resource. When the Israelis catch a hacker, they give him a job. I think this conference, I think of every single one of you as legal, law-abiding citizens that has enormous potential to make a contribution to our national security and our national competitiveness, defined in a wholly new way, defined in a way that recognizes that electronic democracy is about popular intellectual power, and that attempting to encumber that power with mandated encryption systems and things like that is simply not going to fly. And now one final comment on why I am optimistic about your future. Charles Perrow has written a wonderful book called Normal Accidents, Dealing with High-Risk Technologies. He talks about how with simple systems you have single points of failure. They're easy to diagnose. You can fix them rapidly. Complex systems, you have multiple points of failure. They're a little harder to diagnose, a little harder to fix. With constellations of complex systems, you get very quickly to catastrophic failure. It's impossible to diagnose. I think that in this era of complex systems, the power has shifted to the individual, because the power of an individual to completely immobilize, indeed destroy, a major corporation, a major government unit, a major telecommunications system is just phenomenal. Now, I'm concerned. I consider you the forces of good. I consider the people who have picked up some of your methods and are using them for criminal gain, or for malicious satisfaction, I think they're the enemy. And I would be very encouraged if the people associated with HOPE were available at appropriate salaries to help corporations and help others figure out just how many holes are in their tent. Again, as I said earlier, you cannot have a secure corporation if your nation does not have an overall environment that lends itself to security. With that, let me stop and say that I am really, I consider it an enormous privilege to be here. I was going to undress for you. Beneath this suit is a Hacker's 9-0 t-shirt from Lake Tahoe and a pair of shorts. But I do have detractors and enemies, and some of them are in this room, and they would use it against me in Washington. So look for me later in appropriate clothing. With this hat. Now, please, let me... What kind of questions have you always wanted to ask the spy?
Okay, we're going to get to that part in just a moment, and we are offering this speech by Robert Steele, formerly of the CIA and now of Open Sources Solutions in Washington, D.C., who gave the opening address at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference this August. Kind of ironic there. We're offering that along with a full-year subscription of $2,600, the video and the subscription for a pledge of $100. That's 212-279-3400 is the phone number to call. We'll be getting back into the Robert Steele speech in just a moment as he takes a few interesting questions from some of the audience members. Robert Steele is a fascinating person to talk to. He has all kinds of experiences in many different parts of the world with the most powerful people you could probably imagine. And here he is talking to a group of computer hackers about how they fit into the bigger scheme of things and willing to talk about this about anything. Now, you heard a lot of laughter there as he put on a particular hat, but this is radio, so you can't tell what he was wearing. But if you get the video, you'll find out. Yeah, for only $100, you can get that video and a full-year subscription of 2600 Magazine, the winter issue of which has just come out, and... a lot of interesting things in there. We're going to go back to the speech now as he takes some more questions. And again, our phone number is 212-279-3400 if you want a video copy of that speech and the opening part of the Hackers on Planet Earth conference in addition. as well as a full year subscription to the Hacker Quarterly, which will go for four issues. Give us a call now, 212-279-3400. Help support radio that makes this kind of thing possible in the first place. 212-279-3400.
And why do the public agencies in general have to keep their budgets secret?
Okay, that's a two-part question. What's with the NRO, and why did it take them so long to kind of get their act together, and why do intelligence agencies have to keep their budget secret? Well, there are a number of senators that agree with you that the budget should not be secret. Part of the reason for secrecy, let me come at it in reverse, part of the reason for secrecy is that how you spend money tells a lot about your sources and methods. The intelligence community essentially consists of the clandestine operations, which is humans handling agents, where you go out and you recruit someone, you persuade them to betray their country or betray their corporation, usually for money. That's what I did. I was very good at it. And I've left that behind me because I realized a lot of it wasn't very useful. Now, I think we need to do that, but I think we need to do it in a much cleverer way. Right now, it's real easy to recognize who the spies are overseas. My personal opinion is that at least 50% of our clandestine assets, if not more, are already known to local liaison, and they're just stringing us along. I personally feel the clandestine service needs to be doubled in size, but it needs to go deep and long. It needs to have a lot more capability. But if you revealed its budget, you would be revealing a lot about how it does business. So I support secrecy in intelligence. Let me also say Keith Hall, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for Intelligence, just gave a great speech to the Open Source Lunch Club the other day, and he pointed out that intelligence is about secrets. It's about collecting information which is not available by other means. And he firmly placed open sources in the category of other means. There are some nasty, nasty people out there running out all the way from Libya and Iran. The four warrior classes of the future that I talk about are high-tech brutes, low-tech brutes like narco-traffickers and criminals, including you now have a very vicious Vietnamese and Russian criminal gang that's international in scope. Low-tech seers, mobs, Islamic fundamentalism, used improperly. I have nothing against the religion. And then high-tech seers, down to the 13-year-old Pakistani working through U.S. computers that pay his phone bill both ways and coming in and running amok. There's an arms race going on in cyberspace, and we're not competing. So I think secrecy is appropriate for those specific details in the intelligence community. I completely support the community in that, but I think the totality of the budget needs to be known. The other thing that concerns me is that there is a number that is not secret but is not known, and that is how much the U.S. government spends on unclassified information collection, processing, production, and dissemination. You are being ripped off as a taxpayer. I am being ripped off as a taxpayer. The U.S. government is the most inefficient information processing kludge I have ever seen. And that scares the hell out of me because we're in the age of information. Our national competitiveness depends on that. Now, to the NRO. The NRO got its start. I love talking to former members of the NRO. I say, NRO, NRO, NRO. It drives them crazy. Because, you know, I mean, they've gone through their whole life. People, when you go into surgery, they send someone in to make sure you don't say NRO while you're under a gas. Same thing with CIA and NSA. National Reconnaissance Office. Those are the people that build the satellites that collect images and signals. One of the most positive, constructive things the President of the United States has done in recent months is direct Jim Woolsey to put 1 meter resolution imagery into the private sector. Lockheed and ITEC are competing. Now, Spot is doing real-time imagery. Okay, they've got a little neat little thing here now where they can have their satellite over there and they can bring in this thing on a C-130 and you can see it in real time. That's cool. And what the president recognized, which Jim Woolsey and his deputy directors did not recognize, is that times have changed. We can no longer keep the satellite assembly lines open with that kind of restricted customer base. And the power of American brains and American know-how is going to atrophy unless we start doing these things in the commercial market. And I think that it is a shame that... that he had to be embarrassed by the president with some pushing from George Brown on the Space Committee. By the way, a bona fide hacker, Peter Kennedy, is on that Space Committee as an assigned fellow. Robert Kennedy? Thanks. Robert Kennedy is on that committee. And Robert, this is a good hacker story, hacker in Washington. Woolsey's in there testifying to George Brown, and he's staring straight ahead. He's very angry. And Brown turns around, and Robert's sitting behind him. He says, I'd really love to have that poster that shows all the satellites in space. So Robert ambles out of the room. He calls around town. He finds out that the editor of Aviation Week has one over his wall. He jumps in a taxi, races over there, brings it back, puts it on an easel, and George Brown says to Mr. Woolsey, I direct your attention to the number of satellites in space. Are you telling me we can't allow Lockheed to put another one up? And so, Robert, that's making your bones. He really impressed the hell out of those staffers, and that's one small contribution to the progress of this dialogue. Now, the NRO started because we didn't know anything about the Soviet Union. It was a so-called closed society, and it seems to be an American penchant to try and answer hard problems with technology rather than people. And so instead of developing really good legal traveler programs, instead of really putting some effort into debriefing Soviets coming out of the Soviet Union and so on, we built a really gee whiz U-2 followed by satellite. And it took great pictures. The Soviet Union was so important, it took those great pictures day after day after day after day. It didn't take pictures of anywhere else in the world for all practical purposes. And I say this is informed judgment. I was on the Foreign Intelligence Parties Committee and all those other things. It's nice being the second civilian in Marine Corps intelligence. Basically, the system got perverted, and it became a gee whiz kind of program. It was hiding behind so many closed doors that it wasn't accountable. Now let's get to the NRO office building. I mean, in an era of declining intelligence budgets, in an era when we've just put 1 meter resolution imagery into the private sector, do we really need a 10-building complex? No, this is the last hurrah. It's my personal feeling that the NRO did indeed obfuscate its budgetary things. It hid the building in base. Base is stuff that's been previously approved. New initiatives are things that are coming up for the first time, and ongoing initiatives are things that have been approved but are in their 5-year rollover period. I think Dick Concini is setting the stage for the departure of Jim Woolsey. I'd be very pleased if the NRO's office buildings became the new open source intelligence center for the nation. Another question. Yes, sir. Well, okay, that's a three-part thing. One is the assumption I'm primarily military intelligence. That's not correct. I spent 9 years at CIA. I was very proud and pleased to be at CIA. I still respect that organization and the people who work there. I then went to become a civilian in Marine Corps intelligence because they wanted me to stand up the Intel Center. I'm one of the few people that served in 3 of the 4 directorates at CIA. I've done overseas ops. I've done satellites. I've done tech. And I can read and write. And, you know, it was a good package. I was very proud to go to the Marine Corps. God bless them because they changed me. Second item, you assume that the military is very good at buying weapons that kill people and not very good at computers and processing information. Actually, they're not good at either. I helped kill the M1 tank in the Marine Corps. The first time the M1 tank was bought by the Marine Corps, it was bought under pressure from the Army, which needed a larger buy. The Army was pushing the 120 gun so it could take care of the central front. And the Marine Corps didn't have an intelligence center. Now, the M1 tank weighs 70 tons, and it invented the concept of gallons per mile. Okay? It also fries infantrymen in its vicinity. The second time the commandant had the good sense, he had an intelligence center, his colonel asked me, and so I had a little study. We went back and we said, well, weighs 70 tons. European companies will not sell a commercial truck that weighs more than 30 tons to the third world. Why? Bridge loading. Bridges will not carry more than 30 tons on the average. Second, main gun in the third world is a 105. Third, average weight of the battle tank out there is 35, 40 tons. Fourth, you have no cross-country mobility. In other words, the third world tends to be very hazardous terrain outside of about six countries. You can't get from the beach to the capital city off-road. Fourth, line of sight distance, inner visibility is under 900 meters. Geez, maybe we don't need the M1. Maybe we need a helicopter with a big bad stinger on it. But this is an example of unclassified intelligence making a strategic difference in a major procurement effort. Right now, and I've written extensively on this, my article that addresses this point on yours is a critical evaluation of U.S. national intelligence, which was in the intelligence International Journal of Intelligence Counterintelligence. I'm under a lifetime secrecy agreement. All of my written materials are previewed for security. We don't do a very good job of making informed judgments about acquisitions programs. Once a program is underway, we don't do a very good job of understanding the threat as it's changed. You know, when you have a 10 to 15 year procurement process and you have a private sector that is able to develop things in a year or two, and then you have people who can go steal off-the-shelf capabilities, all of a sudden you have this mismatch. Now, on computers, it's not the military, it's not the government, it's the country. Take the chief information officer concept. In my experience, it's mostly the senior tech weenie. That's the last person that should be the chief information officer for a country, for a company. The chief information officer for a company should be responsible for ensuring that every employee is a collector, delivery people, service people, whatever. They should be responsible for ensuring that the information that's collected is put into a corporate-wide database. My friend Paul Straussman invented the concept of corporate information management, which means one-time data entry, corporate-wide access. And they should be responsible for ensuring that the information supports the strategic intent. And so I don't say the military has any answers. I'm saying that we as a country need to come up with some solutions, and you as a group, I think, have a lot to offer. For instance, I'm still waiting to see that killer paper on how I would take down the United States in 24 hours. I mean, Peter Black gave it a stab in Wired magazine. He had a very nice little article that listed, you know, Barking Sands time antenna and Culpeper switch in Virginia and a few other things. That was a fun article. Wynn Schwartzow, his book Terminal Compromise, his lawyers wouldn't let him do this one. This is a great book. You know, do me a favor, improve on this book. This is Information Warfare, Chaos on the Electronic Superhighway. It's got a blurb by one Robert Steele on the back. I obviously believe in this book. This book is my weapon for scaring the hell out of everybody in charge of communications and computing in this country. Wynn Schwartzow, he's here in the white shorts and the Oklahoma version of a Hawaiian shirt. Wynn, are you here? I guess not. He's doing more important things. He's heard me before. But Wynn Schwartzow, I encourage you to talk to him. And frankly, I want you to write the next book. I'd love to see you guys, Hope, as an organization, publish a book on your views on what's wrong with our existing system and how it can be fixed. I don't ask you to publish how to do it, because I trust you. I don't trust the people that will read your book. But I think you have a lot to contribute. Another question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, why do you think the current state of Computer Education America could fund the Computer Education America is non-existent?
Education in America is non-existent.
Exactly. In 1993, school I've gone to in 1989, in elementary school, contained a Tandy color computer, too. And in intermediate school, there are Macintosh 2s, ancient,
yeah,
and a Commodore 64. We're supposed to be the most industrialized nation in the world. We're supposed to be on the edge of the future.
Yeah,
and
but we're not.
Computers are obviously the future.
Let me cut to the chase. The question is, why do we have such lousy computer education in this country? And, of course, I feel we have a terrible education system. I make the comment that we now sentence everybody in the United States to 12 years in prison, followed by 2 to 4 years in a halfway house called graduate school. My stomach turns over when I see a yellow school bus. And I'm going to be watching very carefully when my 5-year-old starts school in September. Part of the problem is the education mafia. The teachers, the educational associations, they're in the Stone Age They do not understand this stuff. Frankly, I would like to think, again, it's very difficult to lead a revolution. It's very difficult to make a revolution. But we're now at a point where you guys represent the new educational system. You're self-taught. You're smart. You're applied. You have unlimited stamina, given an adequate supply of snow cones and other things. Yeah, and I think you represent a new way of learning. We're in a major transition period, and I think that the kind of self-help that you can provide one another, the kind of coming together of boss, of birds of a feather, that's going to be an important part of transition. I'm starting to see hackers that were in jail 2 years ago in very productive junior engineering positions. And I think it's one of the purposes of a forum like this, and one of the things that I try and do in my own activities, including my newsletter, is to help people understand that it's what you can do, not whether you have that diploma. Now, having said that, I would also put an expiration date on all diplomas. all right. You guys want me to stop or more questions? More? All right. You, sir, and then in the back. Please stand up. What? Yes, sensitive compartmented information facilities. Probably not. I suspect the information is available. Part of the is the public aware of how much money has been spent on Tempest, which is emissions protection, so that you can't use the Van Eck emissions effect and use one of those $100,000 Radio Shack vans to capture stuff, or whatever you've cooked up. Tempest is a very viable and important program for protecting secrets. It is unfortunately not at all common in the corporate sector. Hughes STX had an excellent computer and communication security program, and it went belly up because the market wasn't ready. Well, it's ready now. And I think that BDM and a couple of other firms that I'm working with are going to start moving towards serious money-making. The big thing, we were talking about this earlier, is your corporate information systems have 20% proprietary that deserves Tempest protection and 80% that doesn't. But because the proprietary is on the big system, they can't afford to Tempest the whole system. And because the proprietary is on the big system, they won't allow the employees to reach out and barter and share that encyclopedia. So they're losing twice. One of the most fundamental things people have to do is decide what you really want to protect and give it Tempest, full encryption, authentication, reliability, and so on. The other stuff, you need to have an open network, and at the same time, you need to work aggressively through your government representatives, your lobbyists, and so on. I think I'm being thrown off.
Well, yes, actually, Robert, you are being thrown off because we are running out of time, and we do have to move ahead with the program. However, what